I wanted Graham to share with us for all sorts of reasons. Mostly because it encourages us that God's at work and that we're part of that work, but also because I wanted to explore today of all days on Palm Sunday the idea that being part of a crowd can change your life. You know, being part of our crowd has changed Graham's life and he's changed us. You know, he's saying thank you to us, but he is a blessing to us, isn't he, as well? It works two ways in the body of Christ. That's what's so wonderful about it. But not all crowds are such an edifying experience. Some crowds are wonderful to be part of. A year or so ago, Alan and I went on a protest about President Trump coming to visit this country and having, one of those official visits. And I have to say, I haven't been on many protests in my life, but it was the nicest crowd of people I've ever been in. There was a lot of Christians there. There were a lot of denominations represented. Their posters were really funny and witty. It was a lovely atmosphere. No one was being, aggravating. People were being. The police were nice. It was everything that was English in the best possible sense, because there was every colour and creed represented there. And we were all fighting for the same thing, that we felt we wanted to stand up to somebody who was saying and doing dreadful things. And it was a wonderful crowd to be part of. It made you glad to be a human being. There have been other crowds I've been part of which have been less edifying. I can remember walking home from church in the 1980s, walking home from St. Helens back to Whitechapel and being caught up in the Fleet Street riots. Do you remember those? When all the newspapers moved from Fleet Street. And that was not so nice, I have to say. We got out of there pretty quickly because that was an ugly mob. That wasn't nice at all. And the crowd on Palm Sunday was made up of people who knew, some of them knew exactly what they were cheering for, and some of them who were just swept up in the moment, who were just affected by the crowd. But wherever their ultimate loyalties lay, they were all responding to either to Jesus as some kind of ruler, and they may have been confused about what kind of ruler he was, but some of them were responding to Jesus, and some of them were just responding to the crowd around them. Let's look at those responding to Jesus first. Well, there are several types of characters in this story, aren't there? And firstly, there were the disciples. And for a change, their response to Jesus' rule in their lives seems to be just to trust and obey. Mark tells us that they followed Jesus' instructions and that they found things just as he said they would be. And when they take the colt, not surprisingly, they were stopped. Now, I don't know if colt joyriding was a common crime in first century Palestine, but no one likes their stuff being taken without asking, do they? But when they give them the line that Jesus has told them, the owner seems satisfied and Jesus seems to have overruled. I wonder if the disciples have finally learned that it's better to do what Jesus tells you, even if it does feel a little bit weird. How many times have we seen them in the course of the gospel question Jesus? You know, at the time where he feeds the 5,000 and he says, you give them something to eat. And they say, well, with what? And then literally a chapter later when he's feeding the 4,000, they still haven't learned because they ask the same questions and they don't trust Jesus to be able to come up with a solution. But in the course of four chapters and presumably a couple of years of Jesus' ministry, they have at least grasped that it is better to do what Jesus tells you. They seem to have accepted Jesus' gentle rule in their lives. And secondly, the other character I think that's interesting to look at is actually the colt itself, the donkey. We don't know it's a donkey from Mark's account, but Matthew and John tell us that it was the colt of a donkey. But he does tell us that it is an animal that has never been ridden. And maybe I've watched too many cowboy films, but I was always under the impression that animals that have never been ridden can be a bit feisty. And I can't help imagining the people that the disciples talked to about taking that colt, smiling a very wry smile at the thought of whichever lord it was that was going to ride it. And yet it seems that when the disciples throw their coats over it, and when Jesus gets on it, it does not, in fact, turn into some kind of rodeo event, but rather the presence of Jesus calms that animal and allows him to ride it through what for any animal would have been a stressful experience. There was a lot of people in Jerusalem for Passover, millions of people. It was completely overcrowded. And if you think about how much training police horses have to ride through riots, and yet here we have this animal that has never been ridden, with Jesus sat on it, riding through, these people shouting and screaming and singing and running in front of it, laying things in front of it, bright colours, things waving, and somehow this animal trusts Jesus enough to walk through a noisy crowd, taking a rider for the very first time. It seems that Jesus' gentle rule even extends to the animal kingdom. And thirdly, there was the crowd themselves. And this event and welcome has not appeared out of nowhere. Over the course of the last 3 years, Jesus has proved himself to be ruler over everything of any importance. He is ruler over theological arguments. He is ruler over sin. He can forgive sins. He is ruler over the elements and the weather. He can calm the storm. He is a ruler over hunger. He can provide food. And he is a ruler over large crowds yearning to know God. He is a ruler over sickness and disease. And in the week before he arrives in Jerusalem, he is even a ruler over death. John tells us that a large crowd came from Lazarus' house to follow Jesus into town that day. And if you had been there around Lazarus' tomb, I expect you would have followed too. And it's easy for us to see why the crowd would have responded to Jesus in the way that they did. He was extraordinary, and you never knew what he was going to do next. They respond with a mixture of reverence, excitement, and sheer joy at what they had seen, and in the expectation of what they might see next. And so while some people are responding directly to Jesus, undoubtedly some are just caught up in the crowd. There may well have been quite a few visitors to Jerusalem who hadn't seen what Jesus had been doing and who just caught up in what the crowd were doing. And if you've ever been part of a crowd, you'll know that it's very easy to be swept along in the prevailing wind of either anger or euphoria. And where that crowd stands for something positive, that can be a really good thing. I'm sure that many of you, like me, saw pictures of those marches by young people striving for gun control in America. And that's been a very powerful move of not so much euphoria, but positive action in the face of something dreadful in America. And there's something about this crowd that does that too. It seems that the crowd were in a celebrating mood. But what were they celebrating? Well, the journey itself that Jesus was on, leading up to Jerusalem, lends itself to a celebration at the end. The road that Jesus would have come into Jerusalem on was the Jericho Road, and it is a very, very steep climb. Jericho is one of the lowest cities on earth. It's 800 feet below sea level, and in the 12 miles the road that climbs towards Jerusalem is 3,000 feet above sea level. That is one steep climb. And it starts in Jericho, and it's very scrubby and it's desert-like and there's no vegetation. And as you come towards Jerusalem, it becomes lush with olive groves, and the change is striking. And so there would have been a sense of natural euphoria at just reaching the end of the climb. Those who'd followed Jesus would have felt that feeling of when you've got to the top of a mountain that you get. But the season is another cause of celebration. Passover is all about remembering God's saving power for the Israelites over the tyranny of the Egyptians. A God who sends catastrophic plagues on the oppressors and parts the sea for his people to escape and allows them to be saved from the angel of death can easily cope with a few Romans. And if you think about what's happening in this small city, which normally is probably not even as big as Watford, and yet at Passover swells to millions of people, you can understand why this was a very precarious time for the leaders in Jerusalem. These people are remembering with nationalistic fervour and religious fervour that God saves. And there's millions of them. It is a powder keg ready to go off, which the authorities must have been incredibly nervous about. And into this celebration, Jesus rides in. But there's another element in recent memory of these people that we don't think about very much because we don't have it in our Bible. But their recent history would cause them to go a little bit bananas when they saw Jesus riding in the way he did. You see, the other reason that some of the crowd are so happy to see Jesus and welcome him in as an alternative ruler to the ones they have is that they have done something very similar in recent history. 200 years before, the Maccabees staged a religious and military revolution against the Syrian king Antiochus Epiphanes, who had invaded and defiled the temple. And I'm going to read to you from 2 Maccabees, which is one of those books that comes in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and see if you can see some similarities between what we read about on Palm Sunday. Now, Maccabeus and his followers, the Lord leading them on, recovered the temple and the city, and they tore down the altars which had been built in the public square by the foreigners, and also destroyed the sacred precincts. They purified the sanctuary and made another altar of sacrifice. Then, striking fire out of flint, they offered sacrifices. After a lapse of 2 years, and they burned incense and lighted lamps and set out the bread of the presence. And when they had done this, they fell prostrate and besought the Lord that they might never again fall into such misfortunes, but that if they should ever sin, they might be disciplined by him with forbearance and not be handed over to blasphemous and barbarous nations. It happened that on the same day on which the sanctuary had been profaned by the foreigners, the purification of the sanctuary took place, that is, on the 25th day of the same month, which was Chislev. And they celebrated it for 8 days with rejoicing, in the manner of the Feast of Booths, remembering how not long before, during the Feast of Booths, they had been wandering in the mountains and caves like wild animals. Therefore, bearing ivy-wreathed ones and beautiful branches and also fronds of palm, they offered hymns of thanksgiving to him who had given success to the purifying of his own holy place. They decreed by public ordinance and vote that the whole nation of the Jews should observe these days every year. Such then was the end of Antiochus. Now, if you think that's part of your recent history, and the Maccabees ruled as a dynasty for about 100 years after that, so it was only 100 years before, really, that Jesus came riding into town on a donkey, and the next day cleared out all the profanity in the temple, it's not difficult to see why the crowd got the wrong end of the stick, is it? They'd done this before. They'd waved palm branches for their victorious ruler to come in. And perhaps we can have slightly more sympathy for the crowd's fickle praise of Jesus as their ruler when we understand all that background. The problem was that Jesus simply wouldn't live down to their expectations. The Maccabees managed to secure a new royal dynasty for 100 years. But Jesus was establishing a kingdom for all time. He didn't come to renew the temple, and his clearing of the traders and the street food stalls the next day fitted right in with the people's expectations, but what they weren't expecting was a ruler who would actually tear down the temple and all it stood for and rebuild it in 3 days. Jesus was simply too big a ruler, too big a concept for even their excitement and anticipation. And if you think about what they were anticipating, that was pretty huge. And yet Jesus just can't live down to that view of himself. They thought they were ready to take on the Romans, but they weren't ready to welcome the King of Kings. So what is our response today? What is our response to the crowd we sit in today in church and to Jesus? What is Jesus asking us as we imagine him riding into town? Well, I wonder if, like the disciples, he is simply but radically asking us to obey him and to trust him as the only ruler in our lives that we can trust. I wonder if we've made that transition that the disciples made from unbelief and mistrust to complete trust and obedience. I wonder if this morning perhaps we are troubled and restless like that young colt. Do we need Jesus to subdue and calm our troubled hearts and bring peace and a role in his kingdom? I wonder if this morning we are lacking the excitement and anticipation that that crowd had. Has the news that Jesus' kingdom has come become old hat for us these days? Are we trying to make Jesus live down to our expectations? Have we tried to squeeze him into our understanding of him instead of being prepared to be continually surprised and amazed? I wonder, maybe, is this the first time for a long time that we have thought about Jesus' claim to be a ruler in our lives? And are we really having that life-changing experience that Graham is experiencing by being part of the crowd here and knowing that Jesus is the ultimate ruler? Well, whatever the question Jesus is asking us this morning, Holy Week is the perfect time to work on the answer. Whatever you do, don't miss the King coming in. Amen.